Now, what, the way we'll do this is, because you're all shy, is the, did the person next to you have a good question? All right? So if they had a good question, why don't you ask their question? And then Nick's going to run around with the microphone for the sake of the recording, I think. So anybody are you sitting next to somebody had a good question?
I had a good question.
All right. Let's see.
In your... in the previous session, you did a sort of a redefinition of pastoral care.
Which is very interesting. But so, how does that fit in with how people traditionally see pastoral care?
Yeah.
How do you make
it? It wasn't a redefinition. It was a recovery of a biblical definition of pastoral care. Difference. How does that fit in with traditional understandings? So we would have a personal care team in each congregation. We have training in biblical counselling. I think it's a wonderful thing that Biblical Counselling UK are doing. And I think care at the professional end, where you've got really desperate need, where you really need professional expertise, as well. You know, we have three or four levels of care identified in the church, where something is what a small group leader can deal with, something else is what you need experienced staff to deal with, something else is what you need our resident doctor, biblical counsellor to deal with, another needs professional help. So there are different levels of care, and we want to make sure there are care teams in each congregation. That's called caring for people.
And so that is the job of the whole congregation, to bear each other's burdens.
So I said from very early on, I'm not here to bear everybody's burdens. We're all here to bear each other's burdens. I'm here to teach you the Bible and to equip you for your ministries. Some of you will be exceptionally good at bearing other people's burdens. I want to encourage you to do that. But I'm here to do pastoral ministry, which is redemptive. And that is to evangelism, teaching, and leadership in the church. Allah, Ezekiel 34, do it sacrificially as Jesus did it. Not as a hireling, but to love people enough to lay down my life for them. But it's to get them to heaven. So it's just to make clear with the congregation the difference between the specific remit of pastoral ministry and the general obligation to be kind and caring and gentle with one another. And if people need specific help in counselling, provide those teams. It's just not pastoral ministry. Is that clear?
In terms of investing in leadership, what do we do about PCCs?
Yeah. The answer is you gradually appoint over them. Louis XIV had a fantastic policy of dealing with difficult people by giving them insignificant but time-consuming ministries. Basically, he did it with fashion in the French court, and I do it with all sorts of things like prayer diaries and all sorts of things. So it's a way of moving people sideways without being rude. And sometimes that's because I'm a bit gutless and I want to do things nicely. What do you do about PCCs? Depends on who your PCC is. I take it the Bible says we need to have a senior team of elders. That's required. And a church is incomplete without them. It may be that in an Anglican church, that may be called the Rector and Wardens Committee. So a once a month meeting where the rector, the two wardens, whether that's one voted by the church or one chosen by the rector or however that is. Frankly, I don't think anything in the Bible about that. That's for choosing deacons in Acts 6. There's no relevance. But anyway, maybe the rector, the two wardens, or the treasurer. I think the unfortunate thing about that is that a lot of the church doesn't know that that's where the power really lies. What you tend to get with Anglican churches is high confidence, because of the bishop and the weight of tradition and the freehold and so on, what you tend to get is that the senior pastor is safe and can get on with ministry, but the congregation is disengaged. So the advantage is high respect for the vicar, but low engagement of the congregation. At the other end, in the free churches, what you tend to get is very high engagement of the congregation with issues, which means the lead pastor can't get on with anything because it all has to go to a vote. You have to wait for collects forever. So what you want to try and do is combine the strengths of both. So we have a team of elders, but I'm explicitly asking the elders, please allow me and the staff to get on with ministry. And of course, maybe you want to, as in many American churches, that we have now governing elders and ordinary elders. And the governing elders, I pick very, very carefully, and I'm training them to appoint my successor deal with governance and legal issues, and particularly staffing issues. We have three meetings in the week. We have three rotating meetings once a month. And they are, one is on finance, one is on general staff and church issues, and the other is just for me. So I don't want my senior, so I don't want anybody. I need to be looked after because I can do great damage, and I'm absolutely flat out. And so I need them to occasionally give me some time, and they look after me. And I love that about them. But I have to tell them to look after me. I have to explain, you know, I have to train them. I have to say, listen, your most important job is to appoint my successor. So we've talked about my successor. I mean, the tragedies that happen when significant churches are handed on poorly because the elders haven't been trained properly. So that's a key issue. So coming back to the PCC, there's nothing wrong with having a leadership team of some kind or a representative body, PCC, that's consultative. You just don't want them to have authority in the pastoral direction of the church. Now, you either keep that secret in the rector and wardens thing, or you have to start appointing an elders group. Who will they be? I think it's safe to be slow in appointing people, pick people absolutely obvious, just find ways of giving them roles that it becomes obvious that that's who they are. So from amongst the PCC, John and Richard and I are going to be, will be the advisory council. What's that? I don't know. But they're the two obvious leaders. They're spiritually mature, they're safe, they're supportive, they're loyal, and they're here for a while. So my advisory council, let that go for a couple of years, and then you pick somebody else onto it. And somebody says, seems to me the advisory council seems to be making most of the decisions. That's right, actually. So what's the PCC for? Consultation, really important. It's men and women mixed, and so on. It's a consultative body. So does that mean then that you're making decisions? No, we value the consultation role of the PCC, but it's not where authority lies. We're going to leave, okay? Sorry, I'm reducing complex things to statements, but I hope it's stimulating.
David had a good question. At the end of Acts 20, Paul talks about his tent-making work. Is there a place for, particularly in churches which perhaps don't have a lot of money, for appointing staff members who are spending part of their time in the secular workplace earning money?
Yes, I know you know the answer to that. Of course there's a place for it. What we want to be avoiding, though, is going backwards. So we have planted churches where Andrew Nichols, when he first started, was part-time as a doctor because we didn't have the money to pay for him to be full-time. Sometimes with apprentices, they'll be part-time. I try and get them sometimes part-time admin roles for other Christian organisations until the ministry can grow and pay for them. I think to lead by example like that is a fantastic thing. I just think sometimes in a lot of the ministries we're involved with, there's more money there than we realise. And therefore, actually, you could be in danger of diminishing the value of the ministry by allowing it to be too easily unfunded. Having said that, if it really is poor, it's one of the things that a partnership and a network is for. So we fund workers in Longfield, in estate in Croydon, and in Battersea, in a housing estate there, and in the World's End estate in Chelsea. None of those ministries is remotely near to being self-sustaining, and we all contribute into the pot to pay for their workers to be there. So that's what networking should be about. And I would have thought that in a body like this, you would feel ashamed if any of you had to go part-time because there wasn't enough funding to pay for somebody, if it's a good gospel ministry. On the other hand, of course, if the truth is it's not an effective ministry, either because the leader is not effective or because the ministry is just misdirected, and no one's got the courage to say so, someone needs to have the courage to say so. So, look, I think this ministry has had its day, and I think we need to regroup. So we've closed two of our plants. It's like chopping a finger off. It's so painful. But the heart went out of the leadership in it. They'd battled for 4 or 5 years to get growth. They'd seen their growth and it slipped back. And they basically gave up. And so I had to let that happen. Close. Regroup. But I want to, in one sense, I want to keep the sore open and say, we need to go back. When are we going back? Sorry, does that help?
Yeah.
But it's an atmosphere in which we just got to be honest and said, look, I wonder whether it needs somebody else, somebody different kind of makeup. So therefore, we want to close this ministry, regroup, and then a couple of years' time, we'll send somebody else in. You know, you don't want to do what the Church of England does and pour money into dying ministries. And you know, all know Philip Jensen's helpful bell curve. And I'm sure we've all got our own versions of that. Do you want to come back on that, David?
We're just about to embark on the whole process of trying to be more purpose-driven in what we're doing. Can you tell us about the transition that you went through for that to happen? Because obviously it was a shift, isn't it, to move to the witness stuff from just the way you did ministry before.
Yeah, it's a massive shift. So I would say, we tend to do things quite fast. I don't know what your church culture is like. We have a dinner at the beginning of each year, which we launch the year. We bring adults out in the evening, no kids, get people dressed up. And we used to do it congregationally, so we ditched that. We got everybody together. We hired in a whole stack of shiny cafe tables and served bubbly and trying to upgrade what we do. Trying to say, this is an exciting night out, not church on a paper plate, which is what often just undermines, diminishes, devalues everything that we do as a church. So we want to say to people, no, this matters. We want everybody there. We did it on two nights so that people could babysit for each other, everyone could be there. And we presented the vision for the church. And I think everything you can do to endorse the importance and to keep explaining what it means, it's been a massive transition for us. And for a church that, you know, we plant churches regularly, we make big changes, we plant congregations, hardly a breath. But this transition has been massive. So we're still in it in this year. One of the things you're going to have to do, of course, is start staffing that vision. So I'm letting one of our congregational pastors go, as the phrase is. He's been very good about it. He could run a church. He's going off to run his own church. And we're appointing somebody who's not been to theological college, who's 30 years old, to the serve ministry. He'll have a team of 50 people, absolutely committed to welcoming people into our church. That's a big deal for us, to employ somebody full-time who's not been to Bible college. Now, he won't do the instruct team ministry, and he won't do the train team ministry. And actually, our worship leader, we make clear worship is gatherings, family life, and working life. It's all three sections. He's actually theologically trained, but the serve ministry won't. Coming back to the support ministry, the international guy, incidentally, is a guy taking early retirement. So coming back to, he's 52 years old or something, so competent, you know, oil company executive, spends his time travelling, visiting our mission partners, got a big heart, chairman of Friends International, so he's running our international ministry. So you have to start staffing the vision at some point. It's worth talking to Andrew Hurd and the guys that did that. The Hunter Valley people transitioned, so we were particularly interested in the Hunter Valley story of transitioning from congregational. See, you know how you plateau when you're congregational, because you can't fill the preachers in, but everybody else is exhausted. So they transitioned, and one of the things we've emphasised is we haven't overplayed the congregational pastor roles that remain, because you need to soften that role so that the ministries that are across the congregations dominate, and you have to let them be strong. There's an executive meeting that runs those ministries that I'm not in, so I'm out of that. I'm actually in the instruct team, so I'm part of Andrew Nichols' team. I plan the preaching programs and do the bulk of the preaching. So that's where I am in the diagram. I'm in the middle of the instruct team. Now, I'm also senior pastor, so I reserve the right to intrude everywhere. But interestingly, I'm not a control freak. I'm opinionated. So if you keep me out of things, everything can carry on. If you involve me, I've got opinions about everything. So just get me out of the meeting, and you can get on and run it, and it all goes well.
Hi, I'm Steve. I'm pastor of a small church, and I'm trying to relate and learn from what your experiences in a large church are, and relating to a small church. And I have majority of my congregation over a certain age. You know, I got quite a proportion in 90s and late 80s. You used the football analogy of the people watching the professionals. And I understand what you're saying, but if you used the Leicester City model and you saw the documentary last night, all the players thought that the congregation, the spectators, were the 12 men. Were urging them on,
that's right.
Shouting, actively involved. And my point is that we do some services in the community, particularly in the Arundel Festival, and although none of my folk would like to stand up there and do anything out in the public space, they're prepared to be there and stand with you and urge you on. And I think, whilst I understand the analogy of the football stadium, it's not always the reality. Because those people do urge you on.
Okay, let me interact with that. Firstly, yes, I hope that I'm stimulating you to think as a smaller church. We're still in a small church, actually.
What do you define a small church?
Anything under about 5,000. It's very important, though. Somebody already said, you know, we're in a sort of large church. No, you're not. You're in a tiny church. As soon as you start thinking you're a large church, you're giving up. And as a proportion of the local community, you're a tiny proportion. So let's bin all that. We're all small. We're all trying to learn how to grow. So you start thinking you've arrived, you're over. Second, in terms of the senior guys, you can involve senior people in ministry. It doesn't mean they have to do what you need younger people to do. Now, I think, for example, of the tribe in Manchester, the young rapping music ministry in Manchester, run by Andy Hawthorne and so on. Fantastic ministry, fantastic in so many ways. The elderly people have been gathering on Friday evening to pray for that ministry for 25 years. Andy Hawthorne didn't discover that for 10 years. Now, what I mean by that is, young people don't want to go to something with old people. All old people love going to something with young people. So the trouble is, if you run things with elderly people at them, the young people won't want to be there. It's not their fault. It's the young people's fault. It's the prejudice in young people. So what do we have to do? You have to try and organise and say, okay, I need to start something tiny for the young people, but we as the elderly people, we will pray for it, we'll give for it, but we won't be there. So in your situation, for example, I've been thinking to myself, okay, if I can persuade the elderly people that in that self-denying, sacrificial thing, say, listen, could we get enough ministry money to employ an apprentice to join here, to start a young family's ministry? So somebody's a young couple or a young couple with two kids, and basically they can do a holiday club, and from the holiday club, we're going to pray for them and enable them, and give way to them to start something with two families, the only two families we've got. And we'll let those three families run a 9:30 or 10 o'clock congregation, and we'll stay out. We will not go at 10 o'clock. In fact, we'll go later to enable that to start, because that is the future of the church. The broader that base, the bigger the work will be. And if you can persuade your elderly people to understand ministry sufficiently to allow that, to rejoice in it, to pray for it, you can grow that church, that base, underneath what exists. But if you try and do it in the elderly ministry, it's not going to work, would be my gentle and qualified statement. But it can happen. I've seen it happen.